We are now in item seven, at item seven, presentation from Brown Armstrong on our audit. If you'd like to take the front, Harris.
Can you hear us okay, or?
No, that's fine.
You're good.
There are mics on the table.
There should be mics right now. And if you would like to introduce yourself and each, and then I'll leave it to you to decide how to make your presentation.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Rosalva Flores. I'm a partner with Brown Armstrong, and with me is?
I'm Ashley Casey. I'm the audit manager at Brown Armstrong.
And we're here to present to you the results of our audit of your December 31, 2015 financial statements. So included in your packets is just a brief agenda. And along with that are our audit opinions and a copy of the CAFR as well. So I'm just going to kind of start with giving you a quick on the purpose of the audit. As you know, when your organization prepares your financial statements, and once they're issued to the public, you're asserting to the users that the financial statements are accurate and fairly presented in accordance with generally accepted accounting principles. So as your independent auditors, it is our responsibility to review these financial statements, perform an independent audit, and actually render an opinion to assert that management's assertions are in fact accurate, and to let the users know that you're following generally accepted accounting principles. So with that in mind, I'm going to give you also a brief overview of the audit process. Along with that, we're going to go over some of the significant accounting areas just to give you a little bit more about the areas that we look at. And then after that, I'm going to go ahead and go over the audit opinions. And then I'll turn it over then for any questions or comments, or if you have any types of questions on the financial statements. So as far as the audit process, we first begin with having a good discussion with management to coordinate our schedules and to make sure that we are able to deliver on time. So we develop what we call a critical date list. And what we do is we have a weekly discussions or discussions with management as the audit is progressing to make sure that those dates that that we have indicated are in agreement with management. And again, ultimately, we want to make sure that we are able to deliver on time. So as part of our audit, we're also getting an understanding and an evaluation of your internal controls. And these are your checks and balances. This basically makes sure that all your transactions are recorded and reported correctly. And we do this as we're coming out to meet with your staff. We're reviewing the procedures that they're performing. We're inquiring about what things change from year to year and documenting our understanding of each of those areas. So as we're working on the audit, if we identify any items that we see possibly as a potential recommendation, we'll have a discussion with management, we'll bring it to their attention, and then if it's something that we consider might be a benefit of your organization, we'll recommend that as a management discussion item. So as part of the audit also is confirmation with independent third parties. We feel this is a very important process because instead of just coming out and looking at any of the documents that are produced by management, we also go out to your third parties to get information directly from them. So as part of that process, we're confirming with your custodian, your original book of record, all your money managers, to make sure that the information that is provided by the money managers is also in agreement with your custodian. We also confirm a sample with your participants. So we do a sample of, say, 40 to 60 participants, 40 through 60 for actives, and 40 through 60 of the retirees. And what we do with that information is we review each of these letters, and anything that comes back as something that is not in agreement with the records of your organization, we look at it, look through your records, and then we reconcile the differences. What we also do is we also send a confirmation to are your legal attorneys, just to make sure that we have a good understanding of any litigation or any commitments or contingencies that we would have to make sure that they are being disclosed in your financial statements. And then we also send a confirmation letter to your actuary just to make sure we have a good understanding of their professional standing. And then we're also reviewing the valuation that they produce to make sure we have a good understanding of their assumptions, their methodology, and then, of course, to make sure that some of the participants that we've also selected are in agreement with the information that was provided to the actuary. So that kind of summarizes our confirmation process. And then, like I said, we come out and perform what we call interim testing. That's the first portion of the audit. This, again, is when we're testing all your participants, making sure that we're getting an understanding of all your controls. We're reviewing your any new contracts agreements that would be of audit relevance. And then we're also reviewing your minutes, again, just to make sure that we have a good understanding of anything that would affect our audit. And then once your books are closed, we come back out to our final portion of the audit. This is the final fieldwork. And this is when we're reviewing all your documents in relation to the amounts that have been disclosed in your financial statements. So before I go over report presentation, I do want to talk about a little bit about some of the significant audit areas. And when we conduct our audit, we determine which areas we're going to test based on what we call our risk-based approach. So our risk-based approach considers many factors, you know, our understanding of your procedures, risk in certain areas based on previous experience. We also consider risk based on any adjustments that we've had in the past, or just because there might be certain things within the industry that might be considered a risk factor to your organization. So based on that, and as part of our planning, we identify various areas that are considered significant. And these are the areas that we basically devote the majority of our audit efforts to. So those are identified as investments and related earnings, participant data and actuarial information, employee and employer contributions, benefit payments, and GASB 67. And just to briefly go over these, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail just because we did meet with your audit committee twice during the year. We first had an initial meeting to discuss the scope of the audit. And then recently also, as part of our final procedures, we also had a good discussion with them, briefed them on how the audit was coming along. And then we also talked about some of the significant things that we looked at. So I'm not going to go over in great detail, but I just kind of want to touch upon some of them. So in regards to investment and related earnings, like I talked about, we do confirm all your ending balances. And, you know, we're talking about large and significant items here. So we do confirm all your ending balances with both your custodian and your investment managers. And we also obtain the reconciliations to, you know, sometimes there's differences between your book of record and your investment manager because of maybe pending trace or any other differences. Sometimes there's pricing differences. So we do make sure that those two amounts that are being reported are reconciled to an insignificant difference. Another area in regards to investments is we're also taking financial statements when they're available from these money managers, and we're also looking at those to make sure their opinion is not qualified or adverse or anything that would cause us concern. And then we're also looking at the SOC reports, which are their reports are in on internal controls to make sure, you know, there isn't anything that would also raise a flag that would be consider that would possibly have an impact again on your financial statements. And then there's also certain investments where the fair value is not coming from quoted market prices. So in that case, and this would be, for instance, your private equity, we would be looking at other evidence that's provided, including, again, looking at the financial statements to see how they're valuing the assets. And then we're also taking the percentage that's reported by your investment manager. This is the percent based on the total of the financial statements that we're recalculating to the value reported to make sure those amounts also are reasonable and there's not significant differences.
Question for you.
Sure.
So how do you reconcile the private equity value when you're looking at an asset that's not marked to market? What actually helps you determine whether the value is being accurately reflected?
So, like I said, we do get all these reports directly from the third parties, one of them being the financial statements. And so one of the items as part of the confirmation process is we're going to ask the investment manager what percentage of the total fund is this plan investing in this particular fund. And so they provide us with that percentage, and we use that percentage to apply it to the audited number from the financial statements, and so then we compare that to what the custodian is reporting. Does that make sense?
A little bit. I guess I was thinking more about the valuation. In other words, if we carry a particular private equity investment at X million dollars on our books, how do you, independent of market, determine whether that value is reasonable? Or do you? You know, I may not be understanding what you're doing, so.
Okay. I know you have another question. But just really quick, you know, like I said, one of the things is that we are looking at the financial statements. And when we look at the financial statements, we just don't look at the opinion that they provided. We also look at the note on the investments to see how they're valuing it and to see if, you know, to make sure we have a good understanding and does it make sense. But, you know, ultimately, I mean, they're not quoted market prices, so we have to become comfortable with the fact that they are getting an independent audit opinion done.
Okay.
Maybe I'm not quite following here. I'm assuming what you're talking about is let's focus on one fund of privately held assets.
Correct.
So there is no market on them. We paid $100 million 2 years ago. Okay, it's at some point, presumably 2 years later, it's no longer at the $100 million. It's at $90 million or $110 million or what have you. And it's the $110, if we're at $110, that's what we're recording, I assume. Okay, we've moved it up to an assumed market. We've taken $10 million in gain as part of our income. But there's no New York Stock Exchange to go to. How do you confirm the 110 as an appropriate number? That's, I think, my issue is.
Again, we do take the financial statements that are audited from these private companies, and then we apply the percentage that you're investing in to recalculate and compare it to what your custodian is actually booking.
Do those financial statements, are they purporting to be at market as opposed to cost?
They're reporting net asset value.
Right.
At market.
At market, value. Market value?
Correct. Right. Fair value.
At market. Okay.
Correct.
So they went to market, and what we're just doing is confirming
Tim has a point.
That our percent.
Just to clarify, Dipper, do you want to go first? Or?
Go ahead.
Okay. There's a materiality test here as well.
That was one of my questions.
Yeah. When we're talking about privately held assets, private real estate, private equity, remember that our fees are based upon either committed capital or invested capital,
right,
not on fair market value. So while the fair market value is not directly observable, there are methodologies that people use, discounted cash flow analysis, sometimes they carry it at book value for the first year of the investment, generally overly conservative measures. If it's marked up to, if we put $100 million in, we're paying at that $100 million mark. We're not paying on, you know, our fees are not based upon movements in the fair market value. We're worried about our dollars in and our dollars out. That's what our fee basis is based on. Everything else in here is somewhat difficult to observe directly. There are approximations. We have to kind of look at this and say there are approximations, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you're going to be testing, are those approximations being calculated in an appropriate manner and being audited? Is that fair?
Correct, okay. Yes.
And maybe somewhat conservatively? I mean, obviously, ultimately, we're going to get the right number because we're going to get paid back and all the assets will be sold. But in between.
And we also do other things, you know, in looking at, as part of our analytical procedures, and we're also going to be looking at, okay, what was your value in prior year? What was your value in the current year? And why did it fluctuate so much? We're looking at those unrealized gains and losses as well. So there are other things that we look at, but I just kind of wanted to point out that, you know, we are confirming directly, and we're taking that value from an independent audit opinion from another source and reconciling it back to the book of record.
Debbie, did you get, go ahead.
Okay, I have a number of questions.
Sure.
So I think what I'm hearing is first that you're just taking what a firm reports on a financial statement and multiplying that by our percentage ownership, correct?
Well, not only that, we're also, you know.
No, I mean, when you do that part,
correct.
That's the math,
correct.
Right?
Uh-huh.
Is there a discount provided to that financial statement number in terms of if this thing had to be sold before it got out 10 years in the future when it came to complete closure? In other words, our financial statement should be valuing as of today. And so my question is, if you hold a private equity interest of $100 million today, and you're only 4 years into the investment, and it had to be liquidated today, typically accounting principles would dictate that there's some discount to that. Are you applying any kind of discount to those for sale?
No, we're just taking it as of the financial statement date.
So we're making an assumption in the financial statements when we state our fair market value that's the fair market value today, assuming that this investment will be held to the end and completely liquidated in that process, right?
Correct.
Okay. So then you made a statement earlier that made me a little bit nervous when you said financial statements when they're available. Does that mean, or you said audited financial statements when they're available. Does that mean that we have investments in our portfolio that do not have audited financial statements?
Do we get all of them, Ashley?
Well, there might be some cases where they are, you know, they're going to be ones that are not private equity or real estate. They're going to be in your other, because they are like a private company. So
like real assets.
Like Dodge and Cox or something like that. They do not, you know, disclose their financial statements. And so, but we have other methods of verifying those values with market.
Okay.
And we do the quoted market pricing.
And then sometimes.
Testing on those.
But so you're talking about public equities.
Yeah, public.
Okay, so my question is on private equities, real estate, real assets. Are there any of our investments that you did not obtain financial statements?
Audited
financial statements.
Yeah, sometimes at the time of the audit, the final financial statements might not be available because of timing. They mm-hmm. might come maybe a little bit later in June, but we will review the prior year audited financial statements and a roll forward value of what they're presenting in the capital statements in that manner. So at the time of the audit, I can't say 100% we received all of them because some of them were not available at that time.
Okay, so then the last, I think this is the last question. So I think I counted something like 54 private equity investments. And the reason I'm asking this is because our private equity, real estate, real assets, that portfolio is growing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is really becoming more important to us with $1.5 billion in mm-hmm. and almost 19% in that arena. Did you use a testing method to tie out these financial statements, or did you tie out all 54 of them?
We'll do a method of the materiality on each of the funds. I would say we didn't do all 54 of the funds. There's a percentage of them which we tested, and then some of the smaller funds we'll look at reasonableness, compare with the consultant's values, as well as the values which are booked in the book of records. So
to clarify, we don't confirm 100% because I think that's your question.
Can you give me an idea what percentage you did confirm?
I think it's about 80% on, at least 80%, right?
Well, you,
on the private
yeah,
equity?
Usually our threshold would be 80 to 90%.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like we're confirming only 50% on the private equity again, because those are considered higher risk, I mean, we'll do something like 80%,
okay,
which is, you know, based on the materialities, because of the large dollar values, those would be considered insignificant, even if you had any small differences.
Okay, so just to clarify, 80 or 90% of the ones over the materiality threshold, or 80 or 90% of the total?
It's of the total.
Of the total.
Yeah.
Okay. And so on the financial statements that you may have had to roll forward, you said something about you would compare also to the consultant values. So are our consultants also providing a value on these private
Correct,
equity?
And they're also considered a third-party source.
Right. Okay. All right. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Any other questions on investments? Okay. The other area that we also identified as significant were participant data and actuarial information. Obviously, participant data, numerous transactions going through your system. So again, selecting samples of 40 and 60 of each to sample directly with your participants, and also going back to your system and doing a reconciliation for any differences. And as far as the actives, we do verify the contributions were made timely and in accordance with your plan provisions. As far as the retirees, we also take a look at the benefits, whether they're eligible to receive them, and whether these were calculated correctly. So that's part of our participant sampling testing.
Priscilla, several years ago we had a mismatch that if I'm recalling correctly, wasn't caught on the audit. So just asking sort of a broad, this is on participant data.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do things like verify that the total salary amount for the payroll, that's a key part of the input data that goes to the actuary, confirms with independently what you determined to be total compensation and total numbers of actives, retired, vested, not yet retired, et cetera, all confirm? And in other words, at least the aggregates?
Yes. As far as the actuarial information that we also look at, we do, like I said, send a confirmation to your actuary, and they provide us with a sample of what they say. This is their data that they have, and then we reconcile it back to our records. And then they also give us a data that we didn't select. They give it to us from the ones that they pick, and then we go back and reconcile it to your records to make sure that what the custodian the actuarial firm used for developing of their actuary evaluation report is in agreement with your records. And then we also do look at, like you said, total payroll compared to what the system is reporting, and then compared to what the actuary has. Same thing with total of actives that they're reporting, and then same thing with total retirees. And you know, there are usually some differences, but we always come down to small percentage differences that are considered trivial.
Okay. I ask a question.
Oh, of course.
How big is that sample that goes to the actuary?
We did 40, right? 40.
Okay. For, yeah. For each actually active, retired, and then we also do an inactive sample as well.
And our sample size has actually grown, number, you know, obviously from what we used to do. I think we used to only do like 10 of each, and now it's been 40 each. So,
good.
You know, just as another, and I know we're asking for a lot of information, but we just feel that that's another area that is now becoming more of a risk factor, so we want to make sure we're covering it.
Ask away.
Hopefully they won't charge you.
Okay. And then another area also that we spend a lot of time on is on your employee and employer contributions. So we do send confirmations to your sponsors, and also we're making sure that the amounts that they're reporting are in agreement with your records. And then again, we're also doing analytical tests, like I talked about, where we're comparing the total number of members from current to prior year, and developing analytical tests based on the total contributions to make sure we're satisfied with those.
What's your response rate on those?
You know, on the retirees is usually really high. On the actives, it's a little bit lower. I think, to be fair, I think usually it's 80% response rate for the retirees, Ashley, and maybe about...
Do you have a threshold for that? Do you have a limit to...
The only thing that we can do is we'll send second requests, you know, after a month of sending out the first ones. And then, you know, if we don't get a response, you know, like I said, we do perform alternative procedures. So it's not like we're not doing anything. And, you know, there are other organizations that they don't even like to do the confirmations. They bypass all that, and we just do all the testing ourselves for each one of those samples.
And I don't know if you're referring to the actual employers that we were confirming with, but we will get, employer 100% of the confirmations back from them.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were still asking about the participants. I apologize.
We're both, actually.
Both? Okay. Okay, good.
Good. The question about the employer participation got answered, but my second question is, in your review of both employer and employee contributions on the employer side, did you have any occasion to look at our controls for how we manage employer contributions? How we monitor those, make sure they're compliant?
Well, I mean, we do do a, what we call a walkthrough, in that we're getting an understanding over that process with your whatever staff is handling that. And we document to see, you know, are there good controls in that area? Is there anything that we see might be a possible recommendation that we could give as far as, you know, if there's segregation of duties or if we see something that maybe is not being handled correctly? And as part of our procedures, we didn't see anything.
So you didn't see any procedures that you thought needed amending, or you wouldn't, or anything that you thought recommendations were necessary
Correct.
For?
Okay. Correct.
One of the tests that we have had some experience with on the board in the last few years is somebody dying, we didn't know that they had passed away, the check continued to be find its way to their account. So, what kind of test do you go through on the retiree group to be reasonably comfortable that we are not paying to phantom beneficiaries out there?
You know, that was a question that actually came as part of the audit committee too, where they were wanting to see if maybe we could somehow do an additional test on those, especially retirees at a, you know,
over a certain age, 95 or something.
And so we had a good talk about that, and looking at our procedures, we found that you actually have a third party service provider that
they were there at the time
that
too.
Didn't work.
But I mean, we do a random sample though, and like I said, I mean,
you know, this question has this come up with other 37 acts that you have audited where they have had a retiree pass away and then the child has not notified them, so they just kept collecting. Has this issue surfaced in other 37 acts?
Quite a few.
Okay, in so doing, have you found that any of those 37 act counties have a unique way of tracking that error and had greater success than other 37 act counties? And if you have, I don't need you to share it with us here now, but I need you to share that with our administration.
Sure, yeah, absolutely.
And I was just going to mention, you know, some of the larger organizations do have, you know, extensive procedures.
How does LA County keep up with 100,000 retirees?
Well, I was going to say, we audit LA County, and, you know, they do extensively have more of a team on that and have people that actually go out to
do that, to check on
to
it.
Do that, but you know, they have the money and resources to do that.
Yeah.
So I do recall another one of my but this issue had came up a few years ago, and I know they were doing quarterly letters, I believe.
Uh-huh.
That's what they were doing, and I
so
thought that was a
that's
good
the solution.
Yeah.
I heard yes.
I thought that was a good process
is that okay. They're doing annual letters
forged,
and then
you know, it's not that our membership services have
I'm
enough to
fine.
Do we need to give them more to do, right?
But no, I agree, and I think they were doing, like you said, annual letters, but I think on the ones that require follow-up, I think they were doing quarterly.
Did those involve notarization of the signature at any point?
They were, yes.
All right.
Okay. All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Otherwise, you know, it was
yeah.
not.
Otherwise,
it's
anyone
could
have
thought of that one.
Okay.
Any other questions on those?
The only thing that I can think of here, too, is, you know, we have a compliance officer now, and I'm just wondering the impact having one in-house has had on the audit.
Good point.
And any opinion our external auditors would render on performance of our compliance program, how that's been effective?
You know, and that's why we also want to meet with your audit committee, too, because, you know, we do want to have that dialogue. If there's anything that they feel that we should focus on, for instance, if they want us to stratify a particular population for, say, your active retirees, for your deceased, or, you know, we can have a good discussion before the audit, and then we can develop procedures. I think that's important, you know, so that all your questions are being answered and you're satisfied that, you know, if there's a particular concern, that that's being handled through the audit.
And I was just going to mention, you know, I think with the compliance officer coming in and taking a deeper dive into the different departments at the organization has extremely benefited your organization, and with the recent turnover helped to, you know, maintain that, you know, procedures are getting communicated and being performed appropriately.
Well, and that helps us as well.
Yeah. But I think that's what his question was directly.
Yeah, that's what I want to hear. I don't know if you provide that in writing, if you need it as a board, but it's good to hear.
And I think, you know, as he produces reports, you'll see by his findings and recommendations that he is recommending of the work, you know, because whenever you're recommending something to be in process, it's showing up that, you know, with him taking a deeper dive, how much it is benefiting your organization.
Great.
Okay, and then I think we're on benefit payments. So for benefit payments, we are also performing some analytical tests, again, doing comparison from changes over prior year to the current year, and then also looking at the total retirees.
At the what? The last?
Total
last
retirees.
You said you're looking at the what?
Total retirees.
Total retirees.
So, question was it first?
And then on the last one that I wanted to talk about was on GASB 67, as you know. This one was implemented a couple years ago. And as a result of that, you know, there's a lot of additional disclosures that weren't in your CAFR before. And so there's a separate valuation report that's produced. And so we look at your valuation report, reviewing for assumptions and the methodology to see if there's any significant changes. I mean, we're not experts. I mean, that's what you have your actuary for, but we're still, you know, kind of gaining an understanding and making sure that that those assumptions seem reasonable. So one of the other items that was as a result of 67 was disclosure on your money weighted returns. So we are looking at how this percentage is being developed, and we're testing and recalculating it. And again, we're making sure that all your disclosures and your financial statements to comply with GASB 67 are appropriate. Okay, and so I'm going to now go ahead and jump to the audit opinions. You do have your independent audit opinions separately. This is obviously your main opinion on your financial statements. And again, this is providing you the comfort that, you know, there was an independent audit performed, and that the financial amounts as presented that are materially correct. And I'm going to say materially correct because, again, you know, we can't look at every single number. So a couple of things that I wanted to highlight. Well, number one, you are getting an unmodified opinion, which is the highest form of opinion that you can receive. So that means that we were satisfied with all the documentation reviewed and all the procedures that we performed. On the second page, a couple of items that I wanted to highlight. You're going to see two items that are under emphasis of a matter. I just wanted to state that, you know, these items right here are just like the paragraph says, just to emphasize a matter. They don't change your audit opinion at all. The first one is regarding what I just talked about, GASB 67, and because the net pension liability, was a big deal, especially that it was recently implemented. All we're saying here is this is what the net pension liability as it's being disclosed in your financial statement, and we're just saying it's 82% of the fiduciary net position as a percent of the total liability. The discount rate that was used by your actuary was 7%, and I believe that was a change from prior year. I believe prior year was 7.25. I'm sorry. And then on the second paragraph, we also talked about the private equity. This is again just disclosing that of all the investments, about 18% of the total assets were in those types of investments, which again, they are not in publicly listed prices, but you know, we use other procedures to review those values. Anything on the opinion?
Rolling.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to go now to the report to the board. And the first letter is required by audit standards because, you know, we don't get to talk to you on a daily basis. During the conduct of our audit, we're mostly talking with management. And so the audit standards do require us to report to you certain information so that you have all information available. So some of the items that we would want to report to you were, for instance, if there were implementation of new accounting standards, if we had a disagreement with management on any accounting matter, if we had if we proposed a significant audit adjustments, or even if we decided there was an adjustment that was proposed but was not posted to your books. So I don't have anything to report this year on this one. We didn't have any, we didn't implement any new accounting standards. I think the next year is gonna be another busy year with GASB 72. We didn't have, happy to report to you that we didn't have any disagreement with management, and we didn't propose any audit adjustments.
Would you describe what GASB 72 will require?
Sure. GASB 72, we were just talking with Raleigh a little earlier. It's kind of what FASB already has, in which now your investments are going to have to be categorized and put in different buckets. So when we were talking about quoted market prices, for instance, those investments that have readily be available quoted market prices would go in that first bucket. And your private equity would go either into bucket two or bucket three. And net asset value.
So they'll be leveled off at and three different levels, and so it'll be disclosed on the investment type and then separately disclosed any net asset values. So okay. It's more just disclosure and working with your custodian and obtaining that information and evaluations that are done internally in-house.
Now that's something we will do internally and you will verify. So
correct.
That Tim team and Henry and team, yep. Will okay.
And we'll work with management also. We've actually developed in-house what we call a team of GASB 72 implementation team. And we've already developed some checklists that'll help our clients with implementation. I mean, obviously, we want to be able to help you with, you know, any questions and make sure that implementation goes smooth. So we'll be working together with management on that.
And to that point, earlier this year, we actually started a project, just knowing that this was coming down the road. We did an initial assessment. So we've already identified certain investments that we would need to collect additional information in order to bring them up and meet the reporting standards.
This is two or three is a practical matter.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that was my question. Is this disclosure presentation only, or is there actually direction in GASB 72 that will require us to do further work in the evaluation of, you know, the tier two, tier three?
Well, a lot of the information is going to come from your third parties, mm-hmm. but you know, the ultimate responsibility is going to have to be management and how.
Sure, it always is. But mm-hmm. but the GASB 72 itself, is there direction inside of that statement that requires more stringent work on auditing the valuation or determining the valuation?
Yeah, I would say most, in most cases, you will have to take a deeper dive in looking at the specific money managers. Like Raleigh was saying, he's been working on some of those cases already.
And that's required by that statement?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a much, you either, you just can't accept that other valuation, so you have to have a methodology, document that, and that's actually part of your disclosure that you'll actually indicate in your financial report.
And because you guys don't have to implement until the next year, all of the 630 audit clients will have to be implementing now, so you'll have some good examples of disclosures and, you know, what helped or went wrong.
We'll share all the hiccups.
Yeah, on those cases to help you guys with implementation next year as well.
Okay. And our next report is our internal control report, which is commonly called the Yellow Book. And anytime we audit an organization such as yours that follows the Yellow Book, we're also required to review your internal controls and compliance with laws and regulations and make sure that you're in compliance with all your laws and regulations. So I'm happy to report that we didn't find any instances of noncompliance, and we also don't have any significant deficiencies or material weaknesses to report to you. So it's a happy report.
Question on that.
Sure.
It's a happy report, and I'm certainly happy with that. I found the comments on the internal controls to be kind of unfulfilling. It basically said we weren't engaged to really look at that. We don't express an opinion on it, but as long as we were around, we saw some stuff. And that seemed to be okay, but the other stuff, we have no idea. It could be a problem. That left me a little unfulfilled at the end. So is
yeah,
that, is
I'm
that
sorry.
A, is that a pitch for an expanded engagement?
Unfortunately, it is. What it's saying is that if you would like us to look deeper in a specific area, then you would basically engage us to do what there's agreed upon procedures and to where we would look specifically at those procedures that you want us to look at. So if you look at your independent audit opinion, the last paragraph on the first page, it pretty much tells you the same thing, that we looked at your internal control as it related to our financial audit, but the purpose was not to express an opinion on the effectiveness of the internal control.
So is there a, okay, you've answered the question, sorry to make it quite so obvious, but there seems to be a conflict then on, there's another thing that says agreed upon conditions report, and while the first one says we don't express an opinion on the effectiveness, later on in another document it says we did not identify any deficiencies in internal controls that we considered to be a material weakness. That's sort of leaves the impression that you did do an audit of internal controls.
You know, honestly, I don't like this report as much.
You don't like this
report?
Yeah,
I don't, but unfortunately, you know,
sorry to have pointed out this weakness in your own report.
we have to follow the way it's kind of written. Uh-huh. And so, but I agree, it's confusing.
If you were to identify, you know, internal controls that were deficient, mm-hmm. what would those be? Mm-hmm. Give me three or four of them that you would probably say, this is a deficiency. What?
Well, I mean, if you, for instance, if we found that your investment department, for instance, there wasn't any reconciliations, nobody was looking at the reconciliations to reconcile from your custodian to your money managers, then that would be a significant deficiency, depending on what we found as far as the differences in the dollar values.
Give me two others.
Separation of duties, making sure that one person's not doing all the work.
Good. Okay, give me one more.
Yeah, if we found, for instance, that you had someone doing all the transactions.
Right. He's writing up.
I understand that.
Okay. Just as an example. Okay. Because then that could lead to
thank you.
Other significant
I've got
risks.
It.
So, Jerry, just to comment on what you said, the audit committee is actually having discussions about these, you know, separate procedures and the possibility of engaging for some
okay.
other things.
Very good. Thank you.
You mentioned that you have to follow.
I should have known that you guys were on top of this.
Well, I said we've had discussion.
Oh. Todd is going to get equal time on this.
Yeah.
You said you had to follow that procedure, unfortunately. What does that mean? Like, she's making you follow that procedure?
Well, I just mean that, you know, the report, I agree that the language in the report can be confusing. So, you know, this is a standard report, and we can't change it, is what
standard
I
heard. Standard as far as the government?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Yes. And the yellow book.
I feel like I'm watching the Comey hearings. Never mind.
One quick query on this. Is this Sarbanes-Oxley, and it used to be a Section 404?
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah. Yes.
That was a huge revenue producer for CPA firms.
Bali, were we talking about this earlier?
I just wanted to be clear.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's how it got in the bill.
We were talking how there's a lot of these new GASBs too that are now being passed and required to be implemented, but under SEC, you know, they're already in existence, so, you know, GASB's just a little behind, just a little. Then the last report is what we call a management letter, and this letter pretty much just provides you with any additional recommendations that we may have. He's smiling already. That we may have as we're conducting our audit. And sometimes, just to explain to you, sometimes we'll have an item that is discussed with management, and it might not make it to the report just because as we have our discussion, we provided a recommendation, but management came back and provided us with their response, and we felt comfortable with the process. And so it ended up just being a discussion with us that we'll still follow up with next year, but we didn't consider it was significant to be even put on the report. So we don't have any items to report this year.
And on the CAPR, did you review this?
Yes.
For accuracy?
I'm sorry?
For accuracy?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Is that next? Because I have questions on that.
Hope you have a question. Go ahead.
Well, on the CAFR.
They'll go over, but they only opine on certain sections of the CAFR, not
okay.
The full CAFR.
And I figured as much.
She'll go over that.
Okay. So now going to financial statements, I just kind of wanted to mention that, yes, we do go through a thorough review of the financial. Your organization goes for the GFOA award, so as part of that, we do a full review to make sure that it is in compliance also with the GFOA. Obviously, in addition to making sure that it is in conformance with all the GASB standards. And so, as was stated earlier, you know, we do opine on all the financial section. There's other sections within the financial statements that we don't opine on, but we still look at, for instance, your management discussion and analysis. There's a lot of numbers that are financial numbers, and we want to make sure, obviously, that it agrees to the financial section. But because it is written by management and has a lot of management assumptions, we don't opine on it. There's other sections within your CAFR also, the required supplementary information that contains a lot of information also that we also look at, but we don't provide an opinion. And then the sections actuarial, investment, and statistical also we review again, make sure that the information is in agreement with other sections, but we don't provide an opinion. But I wanted to mention that producing this CAFR is a lot of work. And I just want to commend Sacera's staff for putting it together. And, you know, they've gotten the award every year. We take a look at those comments. And, you know, you can see some organizations get pages and pages of comments from the GFOA. And, you know, there weren't a lot of comments from the GFOA for your organization. So, you know, that just says that they put a lot of time on this report. And they should be commended for that. And I also wanted to take the time to thank Gail and all her team that helped us throughout the audit. You know, we come out and ask for a lot of information, and you know, being able to be here and present to you this report, you know, we wouldn't be able to have done it without all their help. So I just wanted to thank them.
Thank you very much for that. I personally want to thank the accounting department and all the staff
for all of their hard work in this. Henry Godino, our new accounting manager, came in on the tail end of the audit process, but he's really come in and hit the ground running, and we're very pleased to have him here.
Thank you, Gail.
Thank you.
I just want to share a couple of comments. I was involved late in the game, but I participated in the award application for GFOA, and coming from the outside, it was good to see that GFOA takes the CAFR and they give it to other cities and committee members, and they look at it, and it's another peer review, and the amount of comments was hardly negligible. Sometimes they have to find something, and so yeah. So I just wanted to share that. That was very good to see.
I'd like to follow that up with a piece. Whenever I'm asked what we do, or how we do it, or what this organization does, I always refer to the CAFRA, and I always try and get people a copy and go through it. And of all the documents all year round, I didn't do it last year all the way, but generally I read it from front to back, because I'm in a lot of the statistics that are in it are really interesting to me, and it's much plainer in this document than almost anything I deal with in the system. So I really appreciate this document. I hope we never stop producing it, and I'm glad that it's an example to other retirement systems throughout the state. It should be. So thank you, and thank you, Gail. And for years, I've always said, ever since I first came on board and started reading this thing, man, I love this. I love this.
So thank you.
There you go.
And we're actually going to be putting on.
Yeah.
Every night you
can't marry it, but
I like the pictures.
Just
saying. I like the pictures.
Just to add on to Jerry's comments, as someone who has to produce a CAFR every year, I know exactly how much work it is. And this document is just a fantastic document. So just echoing the kudos, but it's fantastic. We should be very proud of it.
Yeah. Thank you.
No pressure.
Chair. You're not going to get a raise, but it's good.
Henry's on week five with us. It's just kind of weird.
So I don't know if it's required, but I'm going to move that we accept, thank Brown and Armstrong for their work on the audit reports, and move to accept the report prepared and provided today. With the two items in the motion, one is that the board request that the audit committee consider the issue of GASB 72 and specifically the treatment of non-market assets valuations as part of the scope of its deliberation and potential advice to our external auditor, and that should include our compliance officer and chief investment officer. And two, that the audit committee consider, it sounds like it already is, but just that the audit committee consider the issue of whether and to what extent we can amend our agreed upon procedures with our external auditor to include an evaluation of internal controls. I had the same frustration Jerry did, I think, a year or two ago, not understanding what the opinion was relative to what was actually done. So I think my motion would be that we accept the Brown and Armstrong audit report with the proviso that the audit committee consider both GASB 72 valuation of non-market assets, real assets, and so on, with the compliance officer and CIO, and consider internal controls to the extent that we could amend our agreed upon procedures and have those evaluated. That's my motion.
Is there a second?
I'll second it.
Does this mean that I can't ask questions about the CAFRA?
Oh, and this is a presentation item, so it's not agendized to take action. But we can take those comments into consideration.
Okay.
Our agenda says the retirement board may discuss and take action on the following. And item seven is this item. So I guess that was my proposed action.
I think it's appropriate action.
Okay. It hasn't been agendized as an action item, but that can certainly be direction to a board committee to go that route.
Do we need a vote for that, or just a...
Discussion.
No.
Just a direction, okay.
It's the chair's prerogative to so direct staff.
Let me so direct in that case?
The governance committee.
The audit committee.
I have one piece I'd like added to that, that the audit committee focus on deceased members and the ending of the benefits upon a member passing, that we look at developing or seeing if there's improvements to what we're already doing, because I think that's real important. So I would hope the audit committee would also cover that area.
Okay. And that is a further direction to the committee?
So I'm struggling with the Brown Act issue. I guess my thought is that we need to revisit perhaps how we prepare the agendas. I can't imagine too many things more fundamentally important than receiving and interacting with our external auditors regarding their reports and opinions. And even though it says presentation, our entire agenda is prefaced with the statement that we may discuss and take action on the following, and it includes every item, including what conferences people are going to go to. So from the standpoint of relative importance, I view this as relatively important. So I'm not going to renew the request for a motion in light of the advice, but I would suggest that we reconsider our agenda, because if this isn't specific enough to say that we can take action on any of the following, then we need to be more specific about what we can take action on. That's my thought on that.
Good point.
Yeah, Scott, it is confusing the way it's, ordinarily, most of our agendas, there's a presentation item and then a separate other item for board taking action, and for some reason that's not on this one. It would be appropriate, and I think you do need to take action to receive and file the audited financial statements.
In the past, it's been a presentation without the board having to take action on it, so that's... It's been kind of a grandfathered, but we can take a look at it going forward.
Yeah, I'm just thinking you could. I mean, if we're going to go,
Scott, I would just. I mean, these are important issues, and I think they should be brought up. And I think we should make the recommendation, maybe to the audit committee, to follow through on these things rather than holding up the acceptance of this.
Oh, I'm not holding up the acceptance. Apparently, we've accepted it. So okay. I think we've given direction to the audit committee which is great. I'm just suggesting, as long as we're on the topic, because I don't want it to just get lost, that, you know, there's numerous ways of doing this. If we're gonna separate items by action versus presentation in a more formal way, then all you have to do is next to the item in bold is just put action item.
Right, second item.
Right? A lot of agencies do that. And because to me, okay. I look at it and I see the top of the agenda saying we can take action on any of the following. Well, that means any of the following. It doesn't mean except for the ones that we're not. So.
And I personally like the
good point.
The carte blanche, so to speak, which is my preference, on whatever's listed because of that fact. I mean, otherwise you're going to have action item next to all of these items. Mm-hmm. That we
right.
typically,
that's true.
Is that overkill? I don't know.
We might want to flesh that out a little bit. If we're going to use that legend at the top to mean action on every single item, then we would change the whole idea of putting one item as a presentation and another item as an action and do that. The whole key here is to give notice, fair notice to the public that the board may be taking action on something.
Right.
And so what constitutes really fair notice in that situation could be wide-ranging. Right. I wouldn't get too hung up.
But I mean, just back to the issue in front of us, is it not appropriate that the board actually take a vote to accept the annual audit?
Yes.
I mean, I've seen that happen in every board I've ever
always.
I think there's
accepted.
No harm, no foul.
Right. So
right
I
now, being able to do that, I think
you should take the vote, but
notice issue here. So I would say the board could take
the board could. All right.
Take action to receive and file or to accept the audited financial.
Would you like to state your motion?
Sure. I'll move that we accept the audit report from Brown and Armstrong for the year ended December 31, 2015, and adopt the recommendations we've previously given to the audit committee.
Second.
And is there a second? Second?
Second.
I don't want to rush to a vote. Debbie, you had some additional issues you wanted to discuss?
I just had a couple of questions on a few things in the clarification items in the CAFR, but if you want to take the vote for this, we can ask those afterward. It's not going to affect the vote.
My only thought, though, is should this be all one vote, or should it be broken out and accept the report first, and then, because it is by nature a different action or a request, then do they take another vote on the...
On the CAFR?
No, on the audit committee.
Oh.
Directing the audit committee to fulfill certain...
I'm fine with amending the motion to just move and accept the Brown and Armstrong audit report for the year ended December 31, 2015.
I'm fine with seconding it.
Okay.
Assuming no further discussion on this topic, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Abstained? Motion passes unanimously. Okay.
Okay, so just a couple quick questions I have on the
Just
CAFR.
A point of order then? Could we then simply make sure that we haven't lost the direction
committee.
To staff and the audit committee?
Yeah.
That may not require a motion, but I don't want to lose what Scott's...
I assume we had that, but...
Okay, I just want to make sure we do.
Gail and Todd, are we okay?
Yeah, I think we're good.
Can we make sure it shows up in the minutes?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yep.
Okay.
Okay, so page 26 of the CAFR. I just want to clarify, we have great explanations, and as Jerry said, this is a fantastic document. It's well written. Great explanations of everything in that box that says changes in fiduciary net position, but there's no explanation of what other expenses are. And that's attorneys and what is that? Attorney fees and investments?
There's a mixture of different things that go into that bucket. We can definitely, in future years, provide more of an explanation.
Well, so that bucket is what?
Is it like traveling expenses or?
No. Travel goes into admin expenses or investment expenses.
It's $12 million, so what is it?
Yeah.
Well, it's 50% of the non-pension benefit. Other than pension benefit payments, is 50% of the total. So, I mean, you're right. It's certainly
more than it's more than administrative expenses in total, so what is it? Anybody?
The large portion.
$11 million. Anyone?
The discount that's paid for the prepayment for the employer contributions, which is about, if I recall, like around $8 million.
Say that again.
The discount that is given to the county for the prepayment of contributions, because they're prepaid, that they get a discount on that because the money that's being earned on the contributions is from the beginning of the year whenever they actually deposit those contributions.
Okay.
So in future years, that could be broken out and separately stated.
Do we know that for certain, Ashley?
I can pull out my laptop and get the exact numbers.
Okay, well, let me go on and while you do that. So I thought these were silly questions. Maybe not. This is just a point of future reference, nothing that needs to be done right now. But on page 36, because and Scott beat me to it on the question, but I walked into this meeting with the same exact question as my number one question, which was this: how are we valuing these private equity investments? Okay, and so when I got to this section, which describes methods used to value investments, I really had to read this sentence about four times to before I could finally say, well, okay, maybe that makes sense, but it's not worded very well. And it's the sentence that says, the fair values of private market investments are estimated from fair values provided by real estate investment funds, comma, generally using periodic independent appraisals, comma, and alternative investment managers. It's on the outset, it sounds like you're valuing all private investments based on real estate investment funds. And so I would just reword that. I think it's a little confusing.
Tim shaking his head now.
No.
We do not do that. No. We can clarify the language.
Okay, thank you.
So it's not just them.
So, okay. So that one wasn't silly. So here's my my last one, and I'm just not quite understanding this. It could be correct. Page 42, at the top there, in note 5, on the right-hand side chart, key methods and assumptions used in valuation of total pension liability. Very first one, valuation date, says actuarial determined contribution rates are calculated as of December 31st, 2.5 years prior to the end of the fiscal year in which contributions are reported. I thought generally we have a 1.5 year lag, but is there somehow a way that we get to 2.5?
It's 1.5.
So it's just wrong.
Should be 1.5. Right.
Yeah, you guys lost your award. Right. Yeah. No, I'm just kidding.
It's a good catch.
That's good.
Nice catch.
At the end?
Was it 2.5 years from the end?
See where you are.
To the end of the fiscal year in which contributions are reported.
Yeah, that's
1.5 from the beginning of the fiscal year.
To where we determine.
Oh, 1.5 from the beginning of the fiscal year. So it would be 2.5 from the end.
Okay, so maybe we can just clarify it.
That's correct.
Yeah, we can do that.
All right, you get your award back.
Okay. Yeah, it's kind of confusing the way it's written. We can clarify that.
But I think she was most interested in this.
Okay, that's all I have.
Yeah,
but one comment.
No, I was just in response to your question. You know, on page 56 and 57 of the CAFR, there was a breakdown of admin and investment expenses, respectively. I don't know if that helps answer the other question, but I did look at these in terms of looking at a little better line item perspective of what our admin and investment costs are. I don't think that answers your question on page 27, but. more deliberate breakdown.
One thing I wanted to mention was in last year's CAFR, in the 2014 CAFR, the GASB 68 information was included. You may remember GASB 67 is for pension plans reporting, and 68 is for the employers. In the first year of implementing 67, CSERA decided to include that 68 information in there. In 2015 and in subsequent years, the 68 information will not be included in the CAFR. That's going to be issued separately for a number of different reasons. The plans normally don't include 68 information. It was kind of a bit of an anomaly, but I think in the first year, I think there may have been some reasons to do so.
I think it was for timing. Mostly for timing purposes.
Yeah.
I actually like having it
included. It's a big piece of it. As an employer, though, won't you? As a plan sponsor, you'll include your own 68.
Yeah.
I actually like having them in one document.
Well, part of it is the timing. Mm-hmm. We won't probably have the 68 information until August, looks like.
After
right
evaluation.
Now. Yeah.
Well, which one's 67? Because you always say 67, 68.
So 67 is for the pension plan, and 68 is for the employer.
I'm done.
67 was very much additional disclosures, which we've done, but 68 was where the, you know, NPL, the net pension liability, it's actually shown as a liability on the employer's books.
So the one we spoke, we're talking about the admin expense today, which one is that, 67 or 68?
67.
You want to send those doodles off to
So
you.
Do we know the answer?
Yeah. On page 30, you'll see the detailed statement of fiduciary net position, and you'll see that contribution prepayment discount of 9.9 million, and then you'll see other, which is 1.7 million, which makes up that summarized other expenses on page 26. So did you want me to still, I have it up, what makes up the 1.7 million?
Yeah, run down the list.
There is some legal.
I'm just curious as to $1.7 million that somehow is not considered administrative expenses. And so what it would be? What would it be?
This. We pull on page 26, Mr. Pelletta. Okay, so this becomes.
So.
What's that?
There is. 1 million, which is basically member transfers, employer transfers, retiree adjustments. And then there is other expenses, which are travel, mileage, other professional expenses, some deferred compensation, and permanent salary staff for legal.
So why would any of those things not be administrative expenses?
Well, legal isn't doesn't fall under administrative, because administrative has the 21 basis point statute limitation in the CERL. Okay. So legal expenses are outside of that cap.
So what would member transfers, that first item of $1 million? That doesn't, I mean, what is that?
So
the reserve?
I don't have the exact details of what
I'll provide the detail on that. I'll take a look at it.
Thank you.
But maybe as a minimum, that other expenses on page 26 in future years could be broken at least into the two
largest
key pieces that you do identify on 30. Mm-hmm. And that would obviously put other into a much more
smaller
de minimis. Yeah.
And she did mention mileage and travel, and those are things that are usually in other budgets, but for legal, it would be separate from that.
So that's all legal?
Okay.
Yeah, those are legal.
Yeah. We're not putting travel expenses in other. I just want to clear.
Dang.
Well, it's like outside legal fees just for non-investment is $333,000.
Okay, well, that's another big chunk.
Okay, any further? A very impressive job.
I have one minor point that, and I should confirm that on page 48, it talks about member contributions in the second column for CICERA members range between 7.8 and 2.4, and it talks about contra cost of fire protection district subventing 9% of employers' costs. We just got rid of that in our most recent MOU for Confire. So the firefighters are no longer subventing the employer's portion.
And when did the MOU become effective?
It was effective almost a year ago. So I thought it was last July, but maybe it doesn't. We should check on that. I want to say it wasn't this July, and I want to say it was last July, because that's when most of our contracts expire. But let's just double check on that. And I'm sorry, I should have had Lisa Driscoll confirm that.
Okay. We'll take a look at that.
Okay.
I thank you for bringing that up. I think that's a very important thing that we might consider actually amending this document for, because I know that other people out in the public who look at this stuff, they tend to really focus on that whole fire issue. And given all the fire funding issues that we have going on, I think it's important that issue be corrected in this document. That is truly
but
the case.
But I think MOFD, probably their firefighters are still subventing, so it would just be taking Confire out. But I don't know that their contract has changed in that regard.
Okay.
And if Will were here, he could confirm.
He could tell you.
Well, speaking on behalf of Will.
Yes, exactly. From his seat.
So we'll take a look at that.
Okay, thank you.
I'll talk to Lisa.
Is it correct in 2015 that there were still cases where the employer was subsidizing the employee's contribution?
I believe there is some subvention still going on.
Aren't you guys subventing big time?
Not big time.
Yeah, just a little. Okay.
Not big time.
Okay.
we're as of next April 18th, it'll all be
will
done.
Be, okay. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have used big time.
That's okay. The paper uses time. Big time, that's so right. That's fine.
Part time.
Yeah.
Any other comments on the CAFRA?
If not,
there's a lot of time and effort that goes into this, so it's good to see that people are reading it. So. Mm-hmm.
We are reading it.
We are reading it.
It's been important.
Being read, it is impressive. Thank you.
Thank you for all your questions.
This is an incredibly fast-moving meeting.